wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So, here we are. How are we doing today?
Oh, we're doing very well, Casper. We're 3 weeks into the semester now. At least
yes,
we are.
Anyway,
I think you guys are 4 weeks, are you? I'm not sure.
I'm losing count. Yeah. Honestly, just feels like an endless slog.
I think this is our third week of the semester.
Ah, it is. Okay. So, we're getting into it, keeping busy and everything. And as per usual, we're going to talk science. So, we're going to kick off with Alzheimer's disease, which I guess it's a bit of a downer to start off with. And, I guess what I've got to say is not particularly good either.
Further downer.
Yeah.
Downer on downers.
It's sort of the dark side of science, really, this. So, Alzheimer's, what do we know about Alzheimer's disease? And the answer is not a hell of a lot, which is really unfortunate. So there's a lot of people around the world doing a lot of work trying to figure out what the cause of Alzheimer's is and therefore what a treatment for Alzheimer's could be. And Alzheimer's has been around since 1906, so a guy by the name of Elwes Alzheimer, he took a brain of somebody who had died of dementia or died with dementia, and what he found was that there were lots of plaques and protein deposits and stuff in the brain of this person that shouldn't have been there. And fast forward to 1984, and then they identified what these plaques were made of, and they were made of a protein called amyloid beta. And then 1991, they sort of found a genetic link between essentially this amyloid beta protein, chemist there, and the gene, or a particular gene for that protein that's a precursor of this amyloid beta protein. And so this started the amyloid hypothesis. This is what people were thinking, right, so this must be important in Alzheimer's because we've seen these plaques, we know what these plaques are made of, they're made of this amyloid beta protein, so therefore, you know, let's go and study that. And in 2006, there was a very, very influential paper published in Nature whereby they managed to isolate this thing they called amyloid beta star 56, which is a sort of a subset of this, or a relation, let's say, a relative of this amyloid beta protein. And they supposedly isolated this, and then they injected it into mice that had been trained to run through mazes and all that sort of stuff. And they found that the mice couldn't do it anymore. So they had lost their memory, or you know, it was in some way affecting their memory. And this is enormous, you know, this was an enormous advance in Alzheimer's research, because then it sort of gave people an idea of how this nasty, nasty disease could be treated. And so an awful lot of money then went into this type of study of Alzheimer's. And specifically, we're talking $281 million last year alone. Okay, from the NIH and all the funding.
That's all based on the assumptions or the findings of that study.
Right, a lot of it is, yes. And this is sort of the current idea of, you know, what causes Alzheimer's at the moment. And in fact, last year, there was the first Alzheimer's drug that was actually released on market. And we spoke about this with your predecessors last year. And there was a big stink about that because of the committee that approved this, three people went and resigned straight away because they reckoned it was absolute rubbish and there was no sign that this was displaying any efficacy whatsoever in the treatment of Alzheimer's. So, big problem there. Now, here's where the problem is, and that all studies that have looked to treat Alzheimer's on using this beta amyloid hypothesis or amyloid beta hypothesis have failed. Okay,
it hasn't been replicated once.
It's not so much that's true. This amyloid beta star 56, replicating that has been difficult, and you know, looking at drugs for clinical trials and stuff like that that are based on reducing the amount of protein just doesn't work. So nothing has worked, and now to get even worse, that original 2006 paper has now been called into question, and they're looking at perhaps some of the data in that being fraudulent And that's really, really not good. So this is a guy by the name of Sylvain Lesnay, who was a French postdoc, who was the first author, the lead author of the original 2006 paper. And he's then gone on to an academic career, and, you know, he's pushed this hypothesis, this amyloid beta star 56 hypothesis. And, you know, he's sort of a mid-career person now. He's getting funding from the NIH to study all of this and everything. And, you know, one of the worst things that you can do in science is be accused of fraud. And in particular, the type of fraud that he's been accused of anyway is image manipulation. So
what would really be the incentive to...
Well, that's the thing. I mean, scientific fraud happens, sadly, more often than you'd like it to. And the incentive purely, I think, is fame and money.
I mean, since it was such a significant study too, that the clout he would have received from this and then the further funding and whole career.
Or, no, you know, possible Nobel Prize, you know, all that, you know, all that sort of stuff.
That's right,
what
up there.
That's what people think, I guess.
And you mentioned earlier that just, you know, as the study was published, that there were already questions about whether or not it's actually kind of effective or whether it's reliable.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long did it take for this to lead to a real questioning of the study itself?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because the study itself, or the questioning of the study itself came from a couple of lawyers, in fact, who were looking to find a scientific expert to look at the efficacy or not, I think, of a particular drug. And it, and everything sort of stemmed from that,
which is
really bizarre.
As a result of that.
Yes, yeah. And so basically, the situation at the moment is that the university that this guy Lesnay is working for is investigating. Presumably, higher up authorities are also investigating, and it just remains to be seen where this is going to go. And you know, one of the commentators I was reading was basically saying that this could ultimately end up being a good thing, because it could be the end of this hypothesis that has not been shown to, you know, to actually operate in the real world. And then maybe funding will be...
reallocated?
Yeah, exactly, to other possible theories of the cause and treatment of Alzheimer's. So it's, you know, this is really, really big news in the scientific world, and it's just not good. Nobody comes out of this well. So,
but you mentioned earlier that this sort of fraud happens maybe not all the time, but more often than a lot of people expect.
Yes.
And do people lose confidence in the sort of industry and the research itself?
Well, I don't see how they can't, really. There's a particular website called retractionwatch.com that keeps a note of every single paper in the scientific literature that has been retracted. And in order to be retracted, basically, you're pretty much either as gross incompetence or fraud, one of the two. And, you know, for example, there are, I think, over 100 now COVID papers that have been retracted, because everybody got on the COVID bandwagon and said this, that, and the other thing, and, oh, you know, let's, you know, inject people with God knows what. And so a lot of those have been retracted, but yeah, it's really not good. And you're right, it does shake confidence. So, you know, things like this really have to be dealt with, I think, in the, you know, in the full glow of publicity and everything like that. And people have got to know that these happenings, I guess, are certainly not the norm. You know, they're just a small number of people who are driven by, as I say, you know, money, fame, power, all that sort of stuff. Mm. And, you know, we'd like to think that science is immune from all that sort of stuff, but sadly it's not. So
it's quite harsh. And as I understand, the news doesn't get any lighter from here, does it?
No, let's all get quite down about climate change.
Let's get hot and bothered. Yes, indeed. Okay, so this was a really interesting article in The Guardian in the last week, and sort of led me back to my, very early days in undergraduate science. And thermometers, all to do with thermometers. So we know, for example, that Britain just had a 40-degree day for pretty much the first time in its history. It was 47 degrees in Portugal last month. It was 49 degrees in Delhi. And good old Jarrah in Kuwait had 52.7 degrees. And the question then becomes, yeah, I don't know how hot you guys have sort of experienced. I think my maximum was 47. I was in Oman and it was 47 degrees. It was hot, but it wasn't unbearably so because it was a dry heat.
Yes. That's, you know, what a lot of people say.
They always say, you know,
it's the humidity that gets you.
It is, yeah. and it absolutely is. And that's what this thing, this article in The Guardian is about. It's all about dry bulb and wet bulb temperatures, okay? So a dry bulb temperature, you just get a normal old thermometer, stick it out in the in the shade, and it measures a particular temperature. A wet bulb temperature, you get a piece of towel or something like that, and you wrap the bulb with a wet piece of towel, okay? And as water evaporates from that wet piece of towel, it lowers the temperature, because when water evaporates, it takes heat with it, okay? So the wet bulb temperature is always lower than the dry bulb temperature. But the rate at which that water evaporates is depends on the humidity, okay? Mm. So if it's very humid, then the water can't evaporate very well, okay? And so therefore it doesn't take away as much heat, and so therefore you're going to register a higher temperature the more humid it is. And you might think, well, what's this got to do with anything? It's got to do with sweating, okay? Because we keep ourselves cool by sweating. And for precisely that same reason, okay, as we sweat, okay, so we're evaporating water, so therefore that takes away heat from our insides, basically, and it keeps us cool. Now, if the atmosphere is saturated with water, then the rate at which we can sweat gets less and less and less and less, up to a particular temperature. And that's the whole question of a study that was recently published, is what's the highest wet bulb temperature that we can basically survive at, okay? Because if you're in very, very dry heat, then obviously you can survive, you know, ridiculous temperatures. But it's when the humidity gets you as well. And so there was a study back in 2010, which was purely sort of theoretical, and they said around about 35 degrees wet bulb temperature, they reckon that a healthy human could only last about 6 hours under
such
conditions.
Which doesn't sound like very much.
No, I know. But now they've actually done studies with real life people. Don't ask me how, but I'm presuming they passed ethics approval. But they now lowered that to about 31.5 degrees. And they're saying, okay, a wet bulb temperature of 31.5 degrees, you know, you're not going to survive for very long. And so...
So we're probably closer to reaching sustainable.
That's exactly right. You know, so so in Pakistan and India and Saudi Arabia, Mexico and Australia, for example, there have been examples of 35 degree wet bulb temperatures. Okay, and you know that really is just not survivable. So we're getting closer and closer to that, and it's sort of estimated that for every 1 degree warming that's happening, then that wet bulb temperature goes up by a degree as well, and so we're that much closer to just unsurvivability. And I was thinking about this before, you know, there are very hot parts of the world and very cold parts of the world. It seems that humans have managed to sort of colonize the hot parts of the world, but the really cold parts of the world, we haven't. Have we? Like, you know, all of Antarctica, for example.
Not as of yet.
Yeah. But there's obviously going to be places that people now live in the hot parts of the world, you know, and particularly the Middle East, that they're just not going to be able to do in years to come if this keeps going. And so that's going to create an awful migration, another migration crisis. And, you know, we've got to address this, folks. It's not good.
Well, we don't really have the option to learn to pant like dogs, right?
Casper smiles so smug.
The ability for humans to sweat is really integral to how we respond to climate, right?
You are so right. Absolutely right. Yes. Who knows? We may yet evolve to pant like dogs. I don't know.
Desperate times call for desperate measures.
Question for another day.
Maybe. And how do you think this finding is likely to impact how scientists approach the issue of climate change?
Well, probably in the same way that they are doing right now. I think, you know, it's the scientists who are saying, look, you know, can't go on.
Mm-hmm. Here's further evidence.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the politicians need to start taking note. That's basically it, you know. It's got to come by decree, basically, because I don't think people are going to do it by themselves, sadly. Some do, Some do, obviously, but I still drive a petrol-powered car. Sorry. I mean,
Do we know where New Zealand is in this sort of risk, the scale of risk for reaching the wet bulb temperature that is extreme?
No, I think we're a long way away. I think, you know, anywhere in the tropics. Yeah, so precisely, yeah. Where's the motivation? And we're just a small country, so we're not going to make a difference and all that sort of stuff.
But we may be one of those countries who are taking in a lot of climate refugees coming from other places.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yep, good point. So
everyone feels the ramifications of this sort of thing. Down the line, it's just maybe more immediate in some countries' eyes.
Yep. Yes, indeed. Absolutely. I totally agree. Mm. So, sorry, it's a downer today, folks. Sorry.
Damper, literally, on my... Sorry.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Yeah. On my mood.
Okay, and a quick one to finish with. So, the molecules of life, where did they come from? How did we come to be we? And so that's a question that has obviously long been asked. And there was a very, very famous experiment done back in the 1950s called the Urey-Miller experiment, where they took a mixture of water and ammonia and methane and hydrogen. And they mixed them all up and they passed electric discharges through them. And that was meant to simulate lightning on the early Earth's atmosphere, because those molecules were in the early Earth's atmosphere. And so they let that run for about 10 or 11 days or something like that. And then they analysed what they had in the container. It went a very nice dark red colour, starts colourless, goes dark red. And what they found, they could fish out amino acids. And amino acids are the building blocks of life, because they are the constituents of proteins. And, you know, so that is a possible way that our original building blocks of life were formed, from the primordial atmosphere. So people have continued on this research and looking at it in greater and greater specificity. And so now there's a group at Scripps Institute over in the States, a very, very fine institute, that one, in San Diego. And they are looking at, or have been looking at again, how we went from making amino acids from the primordial atmosphere to how we went to making amino acids in our bodies and our cells and stuff like that. And those are two entirely different chemical processes.
We didn't really use the lightning method.
No, we didn't. And so they've just published a study basically figuring out what the difference is between these two pathways. And this involves molecules called alpha keto acids, which we need not get into here. And also molecules like cyanide, or ions, sorry, like cyanide, which I'm sure you'll all heard of. And basically the guts of it is that they have come up with a plausible mechanism by which we could have gone from that primordial atmosphere into now our biochemical systems that we use in the postbiotic, or the biotic as opposed to the prebiotic ages. So that was a nice little sort of study. You know, a little bit happier than the other two, I think, stories. And yeah, I think that's probably it for the day. That's enough science for the week.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Yeah, it's always a little bit, I find a little bit terrifying sometimes, some of these stories, especially on climate. But
yeah, I know. Sorry to be the bringer of bad news, but we've got to do something about this. That's crazy. Mm. So, yeah.
Fully with you there. Thank you so much, and great to meet you today too.
Yeah, likewise. Yes,
looking forward to the weeks to come.
Absolutely,
really appreciate your time, and we're going to go for a quick break now, followed by a song.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.